Good morning, welcome to the Full Totness Breakfast on Sound Art Radio 102.5 FM with myself, Peter Shearn, and with guests every day. And today we'll be joined by Mr. Sam Richards. Now, he has many hats, this Sam, and one of those hats is his work at Dartington. He is a lecturer and has been a lecturer at Dartington for many years. He was famously sacked. We'll find out all the details of that. I think it's the only one who's been sacked, so I think it's a badge of honour he wears. But we'll find out more about that, because I think it was an issue of morality of some sort that was involved. Nothing sordid, by the way, just a disagreement of the way things should be going. And now that Dartington are charging the £9 to go around the gardens, well, I say now, it's coming up soon. I think on the 19th they start charging, which is this weekend, isn't it? Is that this weekend, 19th? Let's have a quick look. No, it's next Monday. So this weekend is the last time I think you can go around the gardens without paying cash. Anyway, we'll be talking to Sam about all that sort of stuff. A bit of history, a bit of what happened in the past, and what's brought us to this situation at Dartington right now, with Sam, who knows what it's about. So there are connections with Dartington all the way through the choices, and we're starting off with Ravi Shankar.
Thank you.
It's Chants of India, Vandana. Before it's going to go into it, it does that. There you go. Where the Fairport Convention. So Spotify thinks that because I've played Ravi Shankar, I like Fairport Convention. How about that? Well, that was chosen by Sam Richards here. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, Peter. We meet again.
We do. And what a beautiful morning it is.
It is absolutely lovely, isn't it?
It's really glorious. And so why did you choose Ravi Shankar?
Well, I don't know that particular piece, but I thought it would be a good idea to have something of Ravi Shankar if we're going to be discussing Dartington, because he first visited Dartington in the 1930s. And the way that happened was that his elder brother, Uday Shankar, brought a dance troupe over. They performed in the gardens, I believe. It reflected the Elmhurst, particularly Leonard Elmhurst, interest in India.
Right.
I'm not sure what the exact connection was, although something tells me probably Tagore had something to do with it.
You know, the Tagore Festival.
Yes. Rabindranath Tagore was like Leonard Elmhurst's mentor, really, and a lot of the ideas behind Dartington came from what Tagore had done in Bengal. And Leonard Elmhurst had worked for him. I think he was his secretary for a while, and they remained in touch. And one of the reasons Dartington is where it is that Tagore had the idea, you know, that Leonard would be a good chap to do something similar in England. And Tagore had visited Torquay, and he thought it would be a jolly good thing to have this English project near Torquay. And I think this was about as close as to Torquay as they got for a kind of an appropriate property.
Oh, I see. Right, okay.
And, anyway, there was... Now, Uday Shankar was an expert on Indian traditional dance, but he was also a modern choreographer. So it would have been really interesting, I think, to have seen or known what he'd done with those two elements. But also, of course, it's very appropriate for Dartington with its very traditional and yet quite modernist approach to all sorts of things, you know.
Mm.
Anyway, that was when Ravi first came to Dartington, and I distinctly remember the last time he was in Dartington. I think it was in the early 1990s. I'm almost sure it was then. And he did a farewell tour, and he included the Great Hall at Dartington in his tour. I was involved, funnily enough, in a very experimental event of my own on that day, and I missed it.
you missed it?
I missed it.
How did you miss your own event? What happened there?
It was packed out, apparently, but I was doing something else. I had a very big, complicated event that I'd put on, and it lasted the afternoon and part of the evening, and I was exhausted by the end of it, and in any case, Ravi Shankar's concert had started by then, so I didn't hear it.
Oh, what a shame.
It was a shame, yes.
Oh, no, that's a pity, the opportunity. So have you ever seen Ravi Shankar anywhere else?
No, I never did, although I did actually. One of my music professors when I was a student knew him, Alfred Nyman, and he had an extraordinary recording that had been made at somebody's party, in which Ravi Shankar played the sitar.
Oh, right.
And I think it was... Well, Larry Adler was a very well-known harmonica player.
Yes.
And they were jamming together, and there was a third person, and I'm trying to think I think it may have been Yehudi Menuhin on the violin. Anyway, I remember hearing this recording donkeys years ago and thinking, this is precious. And I don't know whether anybody ever got hold of it or issued it as a commercially available recording. That would be worth looking up.
It would, yeah. Larry that Adler was, and Ravi Shankar.
Yeah, that was the closest to Ravi Shankar I ever got, I'm afraid.
But the thing is that there was an ethos behind Dartington then when it started up based on the Tagore connections.
There was, yeah. I think this was and remains the most inspirational part of Dartington. You get this phrase, the Dartington ethos, bandied about in a very imprecise way, but I think it did have some very precise meanings. One was that it was a program of rural reconstruction, and the reason for that, and this I'm sure must have come from Tagore, was that all the energy and frankly all the money in the development of the country, let's talk about England now, or perhaps, was going into urban centres and had done ever since the Industrial Revolution began in the mid-18th century, but particularly throughout the 19th century. And when you get to the beginning of the 20th century, the rural areas were, let's use the word, deprived. They just didn't have that injection, not only of money, but of energy and concentration, and they weren't valued. And there was a movement to kind of reverse that. Let's value them more. Let's find something about them. Let's encourage them. Mm. You find it all over the place. You find it in the arts. You find it, people taking sort of rural themes in the arts. You find it in the revival of folklore, folk music, which was based on sort of rural songs and all that.
Yeah.
It was everywhere. And so the idea of rural reconstruction, it was a kind of countercultural thing because it was counter to the sort of the industrial thrust. But on the other hand, it actually had some very, very valuable things to say to society. And I think it still has, even though times have changed and we're in a very different era. But one of the appeals of the rural was that it was small scale. Well, we even have a college at Dartington named after Schumacher with his famous slogan, small is beautiful. It wasn't just an airy-fairy rural reconstruction. Leonard Elmhurst in particular was very aware of the importance of jobs. People, if you're going to have a program of reconstruction, people have to be able to live there. People have to be able to earn a living there.
It has and to yet, be self-contained.
It weren't the jobs of a punch press operator in a factory. He was very aware of the importance of some sense of integration from your labour. It was also, one has to say, it was a very conscious programme. It was thought out. Sometimes, if you go against the grain, maybe instinct takes you to go against the grain, but sooner or later you have to think things out. And these qualities, especially this quality of real consciousness about what you're doing, is so important these days. When I think of what you mentioned earlier on in this program about reintroducing animals and how do we deal with climate change, the most important thing we have is to be very conscious of it. We can't just sort of waltz around in a sort of semi-conscious way and, like they did in the Industrial Revolution, really. Nobody even noticed how much gunk they were pouring out of factory chimneys. I mean, if they noticed it at all, it was of a picturesque element in a picture by Lowry or somebody,
So it's all based around sustainability, as we would use the word today.
Now, I don't think, well, it may be, actually. I mean, Leonard Elmhurst was very into progressive agriculture. Mm-hmm. And so some of that theme may have shown up. I mean, there were elements of it that are really not acceptable today. For example, he was a pioneer of battery farming. which was considered to be very progressive at the time because it was, you know, incredibly economic. Mm. And that would qualify. So I'm not saying it was a utopia, and it certainly wasn't a blueprint. But when you actually look at some of those qualities of rural, small scale, proper integrated jobs, being conscious about what you're doing, that was all there in the early Dartington.
Yeah.
And these are qualities that I think it could kind of almost base its development on these days.
Well, it's also it's proven itself. If you're saying this is the sort of thing, ethos and thinking is behind Dartington, it's not going to be an accident that Totnes and Dartington are A, so combined, and also B, that they're relatively successful areas.
Yes, that's very true. And Dartington's rural reconstruction, as it was anyway, has kind of had an enormous influence on Totnes.
Hmm.
Modern, especially since the 60s, 1960s.
A lot of people gravitated here in the 60s, didn't they? That's where the hippiedom came from.
That's right. And I think one of the reasons for that was the College of Arts. If you go back before that, let's just sort of peg the dates down. This was the mid-1920s when the Elmhurst purchased the Dartington estate, and they were doing extraordinary things right up until the Second World War and throughout the 50s. There was a thriving culture, but it was very self-contained, and the locals of Totnes might have even been a little suspicious of the strange things that were going on up there, and you know, there were rumours of nudity and witchcraft, and none of them were actually true. But then in the 60s, you got this influx of students, small, very few at first, but by the time you get into the next decade, there's a considerable student population. Some of them did projects within the town of Totnes. At least half of them lived in the town, and it became a kind of a cultural hub, particularly for people involved in the arts.
Yeah.
I think that's really when the sort of the modern Totnes changes from being an old-fashioned market town to something like what it is now.
Yeah. That's interesting. And I think we can move on from there and then get on to your story, your part in, we'll go into what you were saying earlier. I'm not going to give all that away. But Mike Westbrook, now currently still going in Exeter. What was the connection there?
Mike Westbrook lived in Totnes for a while. He brought his big band to Dartington year after year. I can't remember how many years he did that. It may have been about 3 or 4 years. One album that they recorded, and I wish I could remember what the title of it was recorded in the dining room at Higher Close when it was a student centre.
Mm.
And I missed that one because I wasn't there yet. But when I was a student, they brought their big band to what was then the Cider Press. Okay, so the Cider Press is a big retail centre now. But back then, there was a big performing space, and I went to that one. And I was absolutely astonished by this band. I knew a few members from London. I'd come from London, and I'd done some improvising with two or three of the members of the band. So I guess I was attracted in that way, because I didn't really know who Mike Westbrook was. I was only, 18, 19.
Mm.
But it was an astonishing evening. I've never forgotten it. I don't think it was recorded. But the album Celebration, the piece of music that is the album, was certainly trialled at Dartington. They played it once there. But I don't think the recording is from Dartington. I'm sure there'll be some jazz aficionados that will put me right on all this. But the connection with Dartington is very clear. He played there a lot. And then subsequently, for a few years, he ran a jazz summer school at Dartington.
From the album Celebration, Mike Westbrook, a local legend, and that's Awakening. And I've just turned that down because it's a long track, that. So we're going to get back to the story of Dartington. Just as that was starting, you were mentioning that you saw Mike Westbrook play that when you were about, did you say 18, 19?
Yeah, no, it's probably 19, yes, that's right. My story as a student was that I had been to a London music college, the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, because I particularly wanted to study with one particular professor. But I realised as soon as I got there that, you know, with this one person came loads of other stuff that didn't interest me at all. And I had been to a Dartington Summer School of Music. In fact, I think I may have been twice before that.
Oh, they've been going for ages then.
Yeah, the summer school started in the 50s.
Okay, wow.
And I remember this extremely well because I was sitting in the sort of student waiting room at the Guildhall, and I picked up a copy of the Sunday paper. This was a Monday, but the Sunday paper was still lying around.
Mm.
And I saw this advertisement for Dartington College of Arts, I felt my guts twist because I was on my first day at a new college, and I suddenly realised this isn't where I should be. And I really should be at this place that I've already seen, you know. Had no idea, really, what it was like as a college. I mean, it's quite radically different to what it was like as a summer school.
Mm.
But nevertheless, I applied, came for an interview, got in, and then did my 2 years there.
Oh, wow. So that's your beginning. So you quit your original plans and moved down here.
I think some people thought I was probably a bit bonkers because the Guildhall was one of the three top music colleges in the country at that time, the others being the Royal Academy and the Royal College. And there was I'd got into this place and, you know, very prestigious. And yet it wasn't doing what I wanted to do in music. Let's just say it was very crusty. It was very, very conventional. And what was I into? I was into experimental music, marginally into jazz, not as much as I became, and folk music, and, if you like, ethnomusicology, what is now called world music, you know. And all that stuff was barely touched at the Guildhall. In fact, it wasn't touched at all.
Right. So this was your spiritual home.
So for me, yes, Dartington, and particularly the College of Arts, was where I knew I belonged. It's like you get this, you know, I think quite a few people. When I was writing my book about the college, I interviewed a number of people who came up with exactly the same idea of, like, I knew I belonged there. Or, you know, or as soon as I walked into that place, I knew I belonged there. I mean, I'm sure they were seduced by the beauty of the place, you know.
That helps, yeah.
It wasn't only that. For me, yes, it was nice, but I've never been all that bothered by, you know, I could find beauty in the middle of London, not a problem.
Yeah.
And I used to, but the whole ethos, and we've used this word twice now, but the whole ethos of the place and what was going on there, that was where I felt I belonged. Yeah.
Okay, so now it's a bit like the Eagles song. You could check out anytime you like, but you couldn't leave.
Exactly, yes, that's right. What was the title of that song?
Hotel California, that's where I've heard that.
Yeah, Hotel California, yeah, right, yes.
Now, if this was 11 o'clock at night in a pub, we could have gone down that alley, but we're not going to do that. We're going to stay on Dartington.
Well, I think to some extent, what really attracted me was the ethos rather than the details. Because when I started a music course at Dartington, it was called the B course. The A course was for people who wanted to teach in primary schools. The B course was for people who wanted to teach in secondary schools. I didn't want to do either. I was committed to be not a teacher, but I liked to be at Dartington. However, the standard of teaching actually wasn't up to what I'd already experienced at a leading music college.
Mm.
And also, it wasn't really that experimental. You know, if you mentioned, you know, well-known experimenters like John Cage or whatever, people would sort of, look at you a bit funny.
On the other hand, you can't. Can you teach experimentalism? Because isn't it about breaking the molds and going against your teaching? Isn't it a kind of a move away from traditional teaching and that sort of thing anyway? So it's your job to be experimental.
That's true, but I have taught sort of experimental composition events or whatever for many years. It's not that it can't be taught, but it does need to be taught in different ways.
Right.
It can't be taught in the conventional, you know, the orthodox ways. But funnily enough, very little of that was in evidence at Tartington, unless I did it. And I remember doing some huge events when I was a student there. One of which earned me the distinction of being banned from the Great Hall. That was funny.
Tell more.
Given that I've played in there many times since, it didn't really take effect. But
You've got to reveal the story behind that now.
There's a story behind that. I'd written this new piece, which was semi-improvised, but not entirely, and I'd invited some art students to take part in it. And the whole idea was that you put the lights off, you put the lights on, you put the lights off, on, but all for different lengths of time. So dark for, so shall we say, 20 seconds, light for, shall we say, 5 seconds, dark for a minute, light for half a minute, and so on. There was a lighting plot that we used. And one of the instructions was that in the dark, something had to change. Something had to change so that when the lights went up, something would be different. And an art student that I knew took a wooden chair and put it inside the grand piano in the darkness. And when the lights went up, you'd be surprised. There were gasps going around the hall. Somebody had vandalized the piano.
All right, so this is like Martin Creed's artwork, the lights going on and off, but with a little bit more content.
Yeah, I don't think I knew if he was even doing stuff then. I don't think
so.
No,
probably wasn't, no.
But anyway, it was considered to be very shocking, and I was going to get a bill for French polishing and da-da-da. Actually, there was no harm done to the grand piano. But,
yeah.
I remember Darth strode down the hall and said, "This must stop, and I want you tomorrow in my office." So, it wasn't that sympathetic to experimentalism, really, when you think about it.
No, not then. It is now, I think, or in the more recent times. But, you're breaking molds even then.
Yeah, I was. That's true. It was me and maybe two others that I knew of when at my time there that took this sort of thing seriously.
Now, that's interesting because when I was running a business, I had a student who worked in my business, and she was saying that that there was a distinct need to shock or have things that broke molds, even as recently as about 10 years ago.
Yes, I think that whole thing of, one art critic once called it the shock of the new, but, you know, how to use new ideas to shock, basically. That's a whole sort of subject on its own, isn't it?
Because it is a bit, yes. Yes.
We become a bit unshockable, or maybe not. Or maybe you just need bigger shocks, you know?
Yes, yeah, maybe you do. We've come to a point where I think we need to introduce Harry Cox. So why have we got him on the show?
Yeah, and why have we got him? He came from Norfolk. Well, here's the reason. In the 1970s, very well-known English folklorist and folk music collector by the name of Peter Kennedy came to Dartington to set up the Dartington Institute of Traditional Arts. Now, if you haven't heard of this, probably many, many people haven't, because in the end, it was a bit of a failure. And the reasons for the failure, I think, was a very uneasy relationship between Peter Kennedy himself and the Dartington Trust and the Dartington authorities. and he eventually went away to Gloucester. But Peter, from the 1950s and throughout the 60s, had done an enormous job of going around Britain collecting its folk music. And he brought with him his archive of sound recordings that was absolutely second to none. Of course, it was all on reel-to-reel tape in those days. And I actually had a job, not a paid job, but a lovely job, of cataloguing his archive. And that actually meant you had to do it all in real time, of course, in those days. But, well, you would need to these days, I think. But it meant listening to everything. And then, of course, the old system of typing it onto index cards, which is, sounds so prehistoric these days, but that's what we did. So I did catalogue an enormous amount of his archives. Now, one of the folk singers, let's call him a traditional singer, that Peter extensively recorded was this man, Harry Cox, came from Norfolk. And I distinctly remember sitting in the Archway studio listening to Peter's recordings of Harry Cox, like day after day, because this man knew about 200 songs, you know, that he didn't need a prompt for. He could just sing them straight off. Right. And this was the quality of archive that Dartington could have had. And it was just kind of, you know, human relations, not very management and so on, that in the end Peter just gave up and left. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it'd be nice to hear Harry Cox, because he was, you know, he was definitely part of the archive.
So come all you ladies gay, who delights in sailors' joy, come and listen while I sing to you a song. When Jack Tarry comes on shore with his gold and silver in store, there's no one can get rid of it so soon. The first thing Jack requires is a fiddle to his hand, and likewise the best liquor of every kind. And a pretty girl likewise, with two dark and rolling eyes, and Jack Tarry suited to his mind. Now the landlady, she comes in, dressed all in her Sunday best, and she looked like some bright and evening star. She was ready to wait on him, when she find he's plenty of tin, chalk him down 2-for-1 behind the bar. Now Jack, all his rage, he threw bottles at her head, and likewise all the glasses he let fly. And the poor girl in a fright called the watchman of the night, saying, take this young sailor away. Now Jack did understand that his ship lay wanting hands, and to her he then went straight down, with a sweet and a pleasant gale, he unfurled his off the sail, bid a tow to the lasses of the town. Now we laid her on a tack, like a cutter or a smack, as she rolled from the lee to the weather. And we kept her full and buoyed, close to wind as she would lay. We were bound for Blackwall in stormy weather. Stormy weather.
Dorwell. Harry Cox. Well, that's fantastic. Love it.
Fabulous, yes. I mean, you know, you don't hear anybody singing like that these days, but that was the kind of thing that could have been in that Dartington archive.
Yeah, that it would be really valuable now.
Yeah, absolutely. Peter died a few years ago. I don't know quite what happened to his collection, but it'll be around somewhere.
Yes. You've got some stuff, though. You've been collecting yourself, haven't you, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I did. I sort of followed in his footsteps a little bit. I started collecting local songs locally, and then it sort of fanned out to the whole of Devon, and then eventually elsewhere as well, also in Newfoundland in Canada. But yeah,
so it sounds like you were inspired by Peter Kennedy's works.
Yes, and of course that has its roots in Dartington, because that's where he came. That's where I met him. I was already interested in that kind of thing before that, but I never had any idea that I would meet the guy who had edited, what was it, a series of 10 LPs for Topic Records of recordings like the one we've heard. I never thought I'd meet the guy, you know. Dartington did that very well. When I think of some of the people I've met who are really well known in their own field, I think I just casually refer to these people. And then, you know, and then whoever I'm talking to, their eyes pop and they say, what, you met him or her? Yes.
It is. That is something that happens in not just Dartington, but generally the scope of the area. I mean, I'm talking to Sam Richards, for crying out loud. You know, it's that sort of thing, is the intermingling, the all the pretense of celebrity are sort of destroyed in the process of cultural recognition or something like that. Am I talking nonsense?
No, that's right. Yeah, it's very good to have people that are well known, sort of accessible, you know, as members of the community.
Yeah, and I've met several people that I wouldn't have expected to meet in musically because of Dartington. Definitely, the
like what I was saying about Mike Westbrook. You know, I used to say hello to him in the street. Barely knew him, but you know, he's a nice guy. I know him now, but I've spoke more extensively with him.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, fascinating. And the so your part in the story, you went there as a student, and then you moved on to becoming a lecturer.
I did. And after a few years, and initially, I just did some visiting lectures on folk music, actually. But gradually that changed, and the number of hours I taught got more and more, and eventually I was a fully what they call an associate lecturer, which is a posh way of saying hourly paid part-time. And one of the things that I really liked about teaching at Dartington was its openness. By then, I mean, when I referred just now to the fact that it was rather surprisingly orthodox in music when I was a student there, but all that did change. And so in the 90s in particular, maybe 80s, 90s certainly, I taught, for example, improvisation every week at Dartington. And I had my own group of students. Anything from about 5 would turn up to about 30.
Wow.
30 is rather too big a group to work with for improvising.
Be cacophonous at the best of time. Yes, I can imagine.
But somehow or another, and I don't know how many tutors would agree with me here, you sense what Dartington was about in some ways. And one of the things that I think was a key quality was its lofty ambitions for itself. It had a very big idea of itself, maybe too big. But for instance, I think sometime in the 70s, there were a series of conferences and dialogues, often with very famous people. I think they even invited the Pope once, but didn't come. But the whole idea of these Dartington dialogues was to talk about Dartington's message to the world. You know, what could we do here that would be a bit different? What could, you know, are we a microcosm of something that could be greater and useful to the rest of the world? This is a quality that they really need to pick up on now. And though there are things going on at Dartington along those lines, I still don't feel that kind of missionary spirit that there was back then.
Yes, I get the impression from what you say, going on to sort of now, is that rather than being having ideas and leading with them, they seem more on the back foot and are in survival mode.
I think that's true. I think that is absolutely true. I think it's a whole big subject, isn't it? What's happened to Dartington? I think of it as post-college, to be honest, but I think it was before that. I think one could even trace it back to around about 1990.
Oh, as far back as that?
Sorry?
As far back as that?
Yes, as far back as that. I think, you know, that, for example, in the 1990s, there was enormous suspicion, mutual suspicion between the College of Arts and the trustees, so much so that the trustees appointed one of their number to do a kind of survey and interview loads and loads of people to see if there was any way in which some reconciliation could be brought about. And for a small numbers of years, this became what was known as Dartington Plus. And that's a big subject. But, you know, there was tremendous distrust between the trust and the college. So it goes back that far. To be honest, I wonder whether it just goes back to the passing of the Elmhursts. Because when you get an institution that is so firmly based in an individual or a couple's ideology, their ideas and so on, it's actually very, very hard to continue it after they've gone.
You're effectively reproducing or doing a cover band version of the same thing once the originals have gone.
Yeah, and then of course gradually we began to hear the mantra, we don't have Dorothy's checkbook, you know. But I always thought that the loss of the Elmhurst money could be a good thing, because it would force a democratizing influence. It would force the whole institution into the real world where it has to raise funds. And there are all sorts of interesting and innovative ways in which that can be done, which would be based on the place's ideals and not in selling off, you know, bits of land or whatever, you know, which has happened. So
for a long time as well. It's not just a recent thing.
No. Well, it's asset stripping. It was going on in the around about 1990, I guess. But what I'm saying, what I'm trying to sort of, if you like, this is my theme this morning, is that there is so much in the old Dartington model that would be the point of growth. You know, it's modernist progressivism, for example. You know, it's progressive. It was never anti-modernist. You know, there were loads of, you know, artists, you know, people like, you know, Henry Moore, whose statue is still there, and, you know,
Bauhaus buildings and things like that.
Absolutely, you know, that were vital, but were not mainstream. And I always think that Dartington, the core quality of Dartington was a kind of gentle nonconformity. It was almost like, I put in my book the phrase, a genteel ferment. And I think that was true. Because if you actually looked at some of the ideas, even from the very early days, in education, the education of the young, for example, in agriculture, forestry, the arts, certainly. If you actually, let's take the education thing, for example, you know, if you actually looked at what they did in the very earliest days in education, it was revolutionary. And yet, they don't look like revolutionaries, do they? Because they're a bit posh, and they belong to what's sometimes called the anti-bourgeois. You know, it's countercultural, but it's not sort of screaming anarchism at you or whatever. And yet, somehow, they go away with a lot of these things because in a way, the surface didn't look all that threatening. But when you actually got into it, it was like a Trojan horse, the medieval manner and the aristocratic socialism and the counterculture. That was a Trojan horse. Underneath it, there were some really interesting things, you know, that were challenges.
Counterculture stuff. But with the few couple of minutes we got left, literally, is there a positive view on the current situation there from your point of view?
I would like to think there is, but I think an awful lot needs to change. I think there's there's good things happening at Dartington. I'm still waiting with bated breath to see what happens in the new arts school. I don't know much about it and haven't visited it, but I do know some of the people involved. So I'm waiting to see what happens there.
I'm hoping that there'll be more of a communication going on. It does come across a little bit as us and them, and we've got these encampments at both ends, which I think is counterproductive.
Yes, I think that's possibly true. But it needs... dare I use the word leadership? It needs a bit of leadership. What they had with the Elmhursts was leadership. Mm. When they went, I guess that went to the trust. There had been a trust there, though, since 1935. And if you look at the people that were on the trust then, they were all very much Dartington people. They were into the ideals, you know. Not in an impractical way, but they were into the ideals. And I would like to see a little bit more of that idealism.
Right.
Dartington is perfectly positioned to be one of these lofty ambitions. In other words, to be a real contributor to our understanding of things like ecology, climate change, you know, the ghastly thing we're going through at the moment with this pandemic. You know, there are all sorts of areas of understanding that it could lead the world in, and partly because it's got it made, because it's got its lovely grounds and all that, but it's got its reputation and its history and what were its visions.
Well, I'd like to put out an invitation to the Dartington Trust to join me on the show, and let's see if we can get more of a dialogue going, because I think that's what's needed. But we're out of time, Sam. We've got to go.
Oh.
We've got to make way for that damn Julie Mullen.
You know what, I talk too much. But anyway, thank you for asking me on.
No, thank you very much for coming on. There's loads more we could talk about on this, obviously. It'd be great to have you back and we can go more into it as well. But Julie Mullen is waiting in the cat litter room, and she's going to be opening her cake hole very, very soon. And Shelley Zender, I know it gets me every time that, Shelley Zender is joining her on the show as well. So do stay tuned for Julie Mullen, and tomorrow it's the Friday Feeling, so do stay tuned for that. And we're closing with Frank Denyer, music for Shakuhachi. How do you say that?
Shakuhachi.
Yeah. Thank you.